From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter in Dallas, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado is Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And joining me from his tent on Skid Row outside the Cecil Hotel in L.A., it's Mr. Eric Zaldivar. Say hello, Eric.
Hey, I'm glad to be on. I'm protecting my shanty town from a horde of meth heads right now.
Sweet.
Yeah. That's the reference to the movie we're going to watch today.
Well, and I also want you to make sure that there's no, like, nasty stuff in your water, because it could be somebody in the tank on top of the Cecil Hotel. So, you know, just make sure, double check.
She just got in there. That's the mystery. That's all it is.
Yeah.
She's, in her haze of, you know, bipolarism or whatever the problem was, she was left unlocked and she got in. There you go.
She's the kind of person who ends up on Skid Row in L.A. That's all.
Yeah.
So, the movie we're talking about today is The Magnificent Seven. John Sturges, 1960, starring the likes of Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, James Coburn, the man from Uncle, Horst Buchholz, and how could we forget Eli Wallach? Music by R.E.M.'s favorite Elmer Bernstein, or Bernstein, I think that's how Michael Stipe says it. And it is a remake of Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. So before we get started, guys, Eric, what are your thoughts on Seven Samurai, like the source material? What's your relationship with that film?
Saw it in high school, which is probably pretty typical for somebody my age, and I think Hunter's age. So we're talking almost 20 years ago now. It was early high school, and I haven't seen it since. I remember liking it.
You should watch it again.
I wish it was dubbed.
Me too.
I wish it was dubbed.
There is a dub. It's hidden.
Is it any good, though?
It's been out of circulation for years. It's supposedly dubbed by the same people who dubbed, like, the Godzilla films in the early 60s or so, or late 50s.
I'd rather watch it with that. I don't want to sit through 4 hours of subs.
One thing about the dub, too, is that Raymond Burr shows up to comment on the proceedings.
Okay, now we're into funny territory already. is he in an office building?
Yeah.
What's going down below with the...
He's in a Japanese... He's in a Japanese castle, and he describes the battle as it happens, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I've got a copy of the dubbed Yojimbo that somebody sent to me as a file, and it's surprisingly a decent dub, and I don't know why the Criterion has hidden the English dub of Seven Samurai all these years.
It's that film purist stuff.
Nerd crap.
Yeah. Well,
trying
and
to
that's
make the whole dub.
Yeah, that's something that infected... We were talking about anime before the show started. I always liked anime dubs. I always thought most of them were solid. You know, some of them would change the music and would make changes to the film that I thought were unnecessary, but a lot of times I liked dubs, and there was this contingent of anime fans that were really loud that did not represent the majority, and they would hound these companies until, like, that they wanted the pure version, and it was like this dub thing could not even exist. Like, you had to watch the subs, or we would watch fan subs or nothing, you know.
Yeah,
it's very weird.
Ridiculous.
And yeah, so I'd love to have a dub of Seven Samurai, but I don't know. You know, I grew up watching those movies subtitled, so I'm kind of used to it. But, you know, I think Seven Samurai, it's one of the crown jewels of cinema. It's a great movie. John, what about you?
I think I rented it in junior high. Probably not a good time to rent it.
No.
Wasn't really into it the first time I watched it. I watched it years later when I was in my 20s on Laserdisc, and was way more into it. But I've never seen it in a theater. Going to check it out when I think it was Cowboy Booking had re-released them in like 2002. But they were showing it at the local theater in the upstairs cinema, which is the size of a shoebox. So I was like, well, I'd rather just, you know, watch it on video than see it in that
that theater for like three or four hours, however long it was, because it was restored, new subtitles, new translation, everything. Mm-hmm. And it's one that I would probably try to see in a theater if I had a chance. But, I've never been in a hurry to rewatch it just because of the length.
I saw it in high school or college, and I remember thinking, this is a good movie, but it's way too long. And then I watched it when I was an adult and just loved it, loved every second of it. But yeah, it's a great movie. But The Magnificent Seven, is made in 1960, and it stars Yul Brynner. And I was thinking, Eric, you're our resident Western expert. I was wondering what you thought about Yul Brynner's career in Westerns specifically, how you regard him as a Western star.
I can answer that. I will specify, though, I'm resident spaghetti Western expert. That's not a knock on American Westerns. American Westerns are superior by far. But I'm more well-versed in the Italian version.
Listen, I'll decide what you're an expert in, okay? Go ahead.
Well, you are the host. You are the host. But Yul Brynner, I've seen plenty of Yul Brynner Westerns. He's the lead. There was a time where I didn't like Yul Brynner. Not that I actively despise Yul Brynner or anything like that, but I think I'm much more tolerable of him now. There was just something about him that didn't grasp me the way that other actors did. I'm going to talk about Invitation to a Gunfighter a little bit later on in the show when the time comes. So his contribution to the genre is okay, I guess. Magnificent Seven being the crown jewel. I say that as a guy that isn't like super gaga about this movie. In fact, I think I like Samurai. I definitely like Seven Samurai better than I like this one. His contribution to the genre doesn't exactly bowl me over. He also has, of course, what is it with? I always get that one confused with the Jane Fonda movie. But no, Catlow. Has anybody seen Catlow?
No.
No, it's based on a Louis L'Amour novel. I know that.
Yeah, and it's about as average as that novel is. And what are the two big Western staples for Yul Brynner in my eyes, and I think in the eyes of the public? It's Magnificent Seven, and the other movie's not a Western at all. It's sorry for the noise in the background. It's Westworld.
As far as spaghetti Westerns go, he starred in Adios Sabata, which is a spaghetti Western that I think is terrible. And wasn't even supposed to be a Sabata movie, really.
Ironically, as you probably already know, it was the second Sabata movie, but as you pointed out, it was meant to be a movie called Indio Black, You Know What You Are, You're a Terrible Son of a ... you know. That was the Italian title. The ironic thing about Indio Black, a.k.a. Adios Sabata, is that Lee Van Cleef and him traded roles. Lee Van Cleef, of course, being the original Sabata, mm-hmm. and Yul Brynner being the original Chris from Magnificent Seven. Lee Van Cleef plays Chris in the fourth movie, Magnificent Seven Ride.
Interesting. Yeah, that's right. I didn't know that Van Cleef was playing his role specifically. I've never seen the sequels, but we can talk about those in a little bit.
Yeah, but as far as the quality of Adios Sabata, because Yul Brynner is in the role, that's what kind of probably got me to not really like Yul Brynner early on. I don't think he really fits that character very well, even though he's not meant to be that character, but whatever, I digress. He doesn't fit in that world. It's strange. It's an odd thing. But the movie, if you can, it's about as on par with quality in terms of the action and all that as the other two films are in that trilogy.
Well, I don't like it because it denigrates my homie Maximilian, the Emperor of Mexico. I'm sorry that I can't abide that. Same with Two Mules for Sister Sarah. I'm sorry,
Maximilian has become a villain.
Hasn't he gone through enough? He was killed by the Freemasons in the United States. Hasn't he gone through enough, sir? Yeah. Like, do we have to drag him through movies too? Do we have to drag his body through movies too? That man has gone through enough. The Habsburgs have gone through enough. Thank you. Anyway, when I was watching this film, I was thinking about Yul Brynner because I think of him as a Western star because of Magnificent Seven and Westworld. But when you think about it, that's just two movies, and he did a lot of musicals. He did a lot of epics like, the Ten Commandments, The Buccaneer.
Yeah. He did the Brothers Karamazov with William Shatner.
Yes.
That's right.
And
yeah, it's mostly known for The King and I.
Yeah, et cetera, yeah. et cetera. Actually, a lady I work with, her husband got him to come to Dallas to perform on stage in The King and I, in the musicals here. So that's pretty cool. But so, yeah, it's just interesting. He's an interesting guy because he's from Russia. He's bald. He has this look out of time. You know, he doesn't look... to me, Yul Brynner looks like a space alien. He doesn't look like a human. He seems like a comic book character. Like he would play Martian Manhunter if he was alive today.
Oh, yeah. That's a good guess.
I think Martian Manhunter was based on him. I really do. I honestly think they had, like, stills of Brynner when they were drawing Martian Manhunter.
Yeah.
At least in the 60s.
I did something out of character. I watched Justice League, by the way.
Well, what'd you think?
I listened to the podcast as well, and I was miffed because you guys had similar opinions of the stuff that I liked about it. So I feel like I don't want them to think I'm piggybacking off of their shit. But when I first saw it, the two scenes that stuck out to me, like the best stuff in the movie for me, was the introductions of the heroes. I don't remember what Batman's introduction was. I do remember Wonder Woman. I liked that whole scene in the bank. I thought that was really good. But the piece de la resistance of the 4-hour epic was the Flash intro where he saves the girl in the car.
So good.
It's really, really, really good. With the song, Song of the Siren. It's a cover, of course, but the whole thing really worked out. So little individual moments are good, and it reminds me of things that I like in his movies. Like I like the opening of Watchmen with the fist fight with the comedian, and I love the, as obvious as it is to use Times Are Changing for that montage. I love that stuff. And then the movie just kind of, it kind of lives and dies on Jackie Earle Haley. Those things reminded what the Flash intro reminded me of what I liked so much about previous things from him. But I'm not like a super fan of Zack Snyder. I don't really even like any of his movies as a whole for the most part. He kind of turned me off back in 04 when I excitedly went to go see his Dawn of the Dead remake. And what a great opening. One of the best openings of any movie of the past 20 years, maybe more. And then... that's it for me. It's like 20 people in the mall. You don't get to know any of them. And juxtapose that with the original, where it's 4 people, and you get to know their daily routines and stuff, and it's a really cool little film. But anyways, we're getting into Zack Snyder. Overall, Justice League, the highs are high, and the rest of the movie is just kind of a dull drag for me. But I see what people are so excited about, and I'm happy for them.
To me, the reason I'm so excited about it, and we'll get back to Magnificent Seven in a second, but the reason I'm really excited about Justice League is that I feel like popular cinema has been so creatively dead, and this is something exciting, and it's a pressure point I feel that is good to exploit with Hollywood. I feel like AT&T putting it out there has given an opening for that pressure point to hit it and hit it hard and exploit it. Warner Brothers does not want this movie out. They're very against it, and that's why they've been attacking it in interviews even as it comes out. It's AT&T that wants it out. It's good to make a loud noise, make your voice heard by AT&T so they can force Hollywood to make better movies. Because I like the way Zack Snyder films stuff. He makes people look like Greek gods and all that, and I just really enjoy it. But anyway, back to The Magnificent Seven. So, you know, this movie is based on The Seven Samurai, the Kurosawa film. With this movie, you have a movie where you have these guys who all have very distinct personalities going on a mission. I kind of feel like this movie is sort of the blueprint for the Guys on a Mission movie that we see sort of burlesqued in, like... movies like, you know, Inglourious Basterds, but done throughout throughout movies in the decades following it, like The Dirty Dozen, and The Inglourious Basterds, you know, any number of these movies, The Dark of the Sun. What do you think, John?
It'd probably be the second. I think Guns of Navarone has it beat by a few years.
Okay, yeah, you're probably right, yeah.
Guns of Navarone is the first of Men on a Mission for something that's impossible and is basically a fatal suicide mission.
Yeah. And this is 1961.
The first,
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Magnificent Whoa, 7 is so 1960. I guess,
oh wow, okay.
Mag 7 has a beat then. Then Mag 7 is pretty much the blueprint where that you see today for even something like Justice League, where you have the intros of each character and they're recruited, half of them reluctantly. Or I think in Mag 7 it was most of them reluctantly. They took that Seven Samurai formula and condensed it into a 2-hour Western. It ended up being pretty much, yeah, I would agree, the blueprint for all the tough guy, men on a mission type films. I mean, they all follow this formula, which includes the early, kind of the mid-film defeat, and then they have to make the comeback in the finale.
You know, with Brenner plays the role occupied by Takashi Shimura in the Seven Samurai, which is the role of the tough old guy who kind of runs everything. The kind of the role that like Lee Marvin would play in Dirty Dozen. You know, the guy who's been around the block, he knows everything. He's kind of grizzled, he's tired, but he's gonna take on this mission. And Seven Samurai has that stuff where you introduce a character. Like there's the very skilled swordsman played by Seiji Miyaguchi in Seven Samurai, and there's this scene where he has this one-on-one fight with someone where he, you know, just kills this dude in one quick cut. James Coburn plays that role in this movie, and he has a very similar scene where he has a gunfight with a guy, but he takes him out with a knife. And,
yeah, because he claims a knife, he can throw a knife faster than they can draw a gun.
Yeah. Coburn apparently was a big fan of that character in Seven Samurai, and when he found out they hadn't cast that equivalent yet, he was like, that's the part I'd like to play. But yeah, we have those introductions in Seven Samurai, and it carries over. I think Magnificent Seven sort of recognizes that and really amplifies it. Eric, what do you think about this being the guys on a mission movie? Does it carry over to Italian cinema, do you think?
Oh, it does. There were several men on a mission movie for particularly Westerns. Three of them star Bud Spencer, actually. There's a Massacre at Fort Holman, or also called Reason to Live or Reason to Die. There's Tomorrow We Die, or Today You Die, Tomorrow We Kill, with Brett Halsey and Bud Spencer. And then there's Five Man Army, which is a Mission Impossible kind of riff, because it has Peter Graves in it as the leader of the bunch. And Bud Spencer's the strong man. He always plays the strong man. But yeah, as we just pointed out, Guns of Navarone, a year later. Magnificent Seven probably is the foundation of all these movies.
You know, we all know that Italian films love to take their cues from Hollywood. Is this film the reason, another star, you know, the villain is played by Eli Wallach. Seven Samurai did not have a really clearly defined villain character. The leader of the bandits was just sort of an eye-patched dude. The bandits were sort of a force of nature. They weren't really characters. But in Magnificent Seven, they have a bandit leader. He's a very big character, and he's played by Eli Wallach. Eli Wallach actually said when he came to do this movie and he asked what role they wanted him to play, they said the bandit leader, and he was like, well, I've seen Seven Samurai, and that's a nothing role. You know, he didn't think it was interesting. But then when he read the script, he understood that it's a bigger role and that he has something to do. But is this movie, do you think this movie is why Leone cast him in Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
Oh, that's reaching back into the memory banks. I want to say that, yeah, that probably had a lot to do with it. Yes, in fact, it probably was. And, you know, anytime he plays an ethnic, a Mexican or something, he's playing that role again. Like, Tuco is basically just a nicer version of Calavera. And do you want me to run through the list of movies that he also played a Mexican in?
Yes.
He plays a okay. He plays the Tuco like character, although he plays, it's a Greek, Karpopoulos, I believe, or Karpopoulos, I believe is his name, in God Forgives I Don't sequel, Ace High. He's basically, it doesn't matter if he's playing Tuco, it might as well just be Mexican, it doesn't matter. And then he played Mexican again, basically Tuco, in a Franco Nero remake, a second remake of The Mercenary, where he plays the Tomas Milian role, or the Tony Musante role, Wallach does, in A Toast to Your Death. Or
that title! I thought you said A Toast to Your Death at first.
It is. No, it's true. No. That's the alternate title. There's three titles that I know of. Don't Turn the Other Cheek. That's one. Then there's A Toast to Your Death. And then there is Long Live Your Death.
Listen, I thought you said a toastier death.
A toastier death. Oh, that would like, that would have been the best
like,
of all.
Like, this death is mighty toasty.
The guy comes on the bottom third of the screen and says, Toasty!
And
no matter what, he always dubs those characters with that bandit voice.
Yeah, exactly. Always, every time, it's the same one. Did you, Hunter, you got the Mortal Kombat reference, right?
Of course. Toasty! Yes. Yeah.
They should go all out with the next Mortal Kombat. It looks boring as shit, so they might as well just have a guy show up on the bottom half of the screen, go, Toasty! And then come back out.
Anytime someone gets their spine ripped out, he just pops in and goes, Toasty!
He should.
Apparently, that's all this is just gore and blood and spines getting ripped out. That's it.
How much you want to bet it's going to bomb?
Oh, I'm sure it's going to suck.
I'll bet you it's not going to do well, and the whole thing is the fatalities. I know we covered this on the show recently, but the Paul W.S. Anderson Mortal Kombat, I think, understood Mortal Kombat better than this does. It's Mortal Kombat for someone who watches fatality compilations on YouTube.
It looks like a sci-fi original. It looks really cheap.
It's like Man with the Iron Fist Part 3.
I always hate being reminded of Man with the Iron Fists.
That exists. That was made.
And speaking of Leone, a big part of Leone's films is the music. The Elmer Bernstein score for Magnificent Seven, you have one of the most iconic Western scores here. It's up there with Morricone for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's up there with Tex Ritter on High Noon. You know, this is a iconic Western score. Do you think that kind of translated to Italy as well, having this rich score that just you think of the movie when you hear it?
Maybe subliminally. I think the Italians were doing different things with their scores. Mm. So I don't necessarily think Magnificent Seven, the main theme, which is of course so iconic, I'm not sure if that had anything to do with it did not influence Ennio Morricone. That would be my guess. You'd have to ask him. I don't know. But
I'll go to his grave and I'll see if I can get a response.
Oh, that's right. Holy shit, he died. I forgot.
he'll rise out of the grave and go, Tarantino, now let me fuck his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I just had my old scores. I don't do a new score for him.
But I will say the Bernstein Bear score is really good, and I don't think he gets enough credit for lesser westerns. Although I like The Sons of Katie Elder a lot better. The Sons of Katie. Go and listen to the main theme by Elmer Bernstein of The Sons of Katie Elder. Tell me that doesn't compete, if not better.
Really.
Magnificent Seven, please.
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm going to have to check. That's one I have in my to-watch pile that I haven't watched yet.
You ever seen that, Hunter?
No, I've never seen it. Isn't that crazy?
God, I watched it at least twice.
The first time I saw it, I wasn't, like, too keen on it. But one day, I just, like, sat down and was just like, sure, I'll watch Sons of Katie Elder. And I was half an hour in, and I was just like, why can't movies be like this today?
I didn't like it the first time I saw it. Did not care for it. And then I watched it again, and I dug it. And I was like, I don't know what the hell happened.
Yeah, neither do I.
John Sturges directed this film. Sturges is a favorite director of mine. Every movie I've seen of his, I haven't seen all of them, but every single one I've seen, I have enjoyed immensely. Bad Day at Black Rock, a film that's very similar to this that he did 3 years later, The Great Escape, I think has a lot of similarities. Ice Station Zebra. Probably my least favorite film of his I've seen is Joe Kidd with Clint Eastwood.
Oh, I got a worse one for you.
Oh, what's that?
Well, the thing about John Sturges, before I get into that, is like, I'm with you. When John Sturges cares, you get Bad Day at Black Rock, you get The Great Escape. But when he doesn't care, you get Joe Kidd and you get Chino.
Well, that's what's funny is I have a friend who hates John Sturges. And he says that he's a director who clearly doesn't care, that he doesn't direct, that he's a lazy director. And I was like, what are you talking about? He cited a bunch of movies that I hadn't seen. Clearly, I guess I'm watching the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
Joe Kidd was the first movie of his I saw that I really didn't care for. It's not the worst Clint Western. Two Mules for Sister Sarah is much worse.
No, come on. Unforgiven is worse.
Pale Rider is worse.
Unforgiven is the worst. I'm just kidding.
Unforgiven is close to the worst.
I'm sorry. Two Mules. Man. Again, you impugn my boy Maximilian. I don't like that. I don't like Clint getting tricked that she's a nun, but it turns out she's a whore. You know, I don't like that. It's not good.
One of these days, I'm gonna have to finish that movie.
It's not worth it.
It's not worth it.
I'm gonna get that Blu-ray box set that comes with like all these unloved Clint movies.
The unloved Clint collection.
Yeah. It's Two Mules. I think it comes also with the Iger sanction, like movies that
the Universal stuff.
Oh man.
Yeah, the Universal stuff. I'm gonna get that paycheck.
It was really funny. I was talking to my dad the other day, and I mentioned that I watched Two Mules for Sister Sarah, and he held his nose.
Did he do the monkey thing from Grace?
Yeah. He does that. He does. Did I tell you that?
You did, yeah.
Yes, my dad. When he doesn't like something, he pretends to be the monkey from Greystoke and goes, whoo, 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 whoo. Ever since we watched that movie.
Yeah, Sister Sarah is a monkey movie for sure.
Yeah, more so than Every Which Way But Loose.
Oh boy. I agree with you. Joe Kidd is actually slightly better than Sister Sarah.
Yeah, I would rather watch Joe Kidd, because Joe Kidd has some moments. It's got some cool stuff in it, but it's got those cool Clint moments. I like the beginning of Two Mules, and that's it. You know,
the beginning is good, and that is all. And Joe Kidd has a locomotive,
yes,
crashing through a saloon. So yes. You got that.
You got that. You've also got a few good actors in there. But with John Sturges, you know, he has some really good films. I haven't seen all of his movies, but everything I've seen except Joe Kidd, I've really enjoyed. I haven't seen McHugh. One that's in my to-watch pile is Escape from Fort Bravo. But Bad Day at Black Rock, that's one I've seen. I don't know how many times we've covered it on the show. But just really fun movie. Gunfight at the OK Corral.
I got to rewatch Gunfight. I was rewatching it on Hulu or something, and it's playing a lot better. I figured it would, too, than I did when I saw it as a teen.
It's produced by the great Hal Wallace, too.
Did he do the sequel? I'm thinking John Sturges did. Hour of the Gun.
Yeah, he did.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not terribly good. It's okay, from what I remember.
This movie, I know that Kurosawa was a big fan of it, and I heard somewhere, I can't cite my source, but that he sent a samurai sword to Sturges as a like good job.
Yeah, they've tried to revise that history and claim he didn't like it, but they basically took a quote of his out of context. Where he said cowboys aren't samurais, but as if that was a bad review. But no, he actually liked it.
Yeah.
Well, he's a big Hollywood junkie, so that makes
sense. Yeah, he was totally a Hollywood worshiper. So he was pleased by it.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, for a long time when you would look at the Japanese and what they thought of their films, you know, it took them a while to kind of come around to Kurosawa.
Because I thought his stuff was too Hollywood.
Yeah. He was too influenced by Hollywood. You know, they would say they prefer a Mizoguchi or an Ozu or a Kore-eda or something. Now they recognize that Kurosawa is probably responsible for spreading Japanese cinema to the West more than him and Ishiro Honda, his good friend, are probably the two most internationally revered Japanese directors. Honda for completely different movies.
Yes.
But
he became Kurosawa's second unit guy.
Yeah.
Dreams and Ron.
Yeah.
Pretty much really the director.
Yeah, he ghost directed those because Kurosawa was going blind. And if you watch something like Dreams, the Mount Fuji in Red segment, that's a Honda film. That's an art house Honda film right there.
That's what they wanted Godzilla versus Biollante to be.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm going through John Sturges' filmography here, and I'm looking at stuff that I was just like, I gotta watch that Jane Russell underwater movie, because it's just Hollywood fluff, but it's her, you know, half naked throughout the whole film, so why not?
Not underwater, it's underwater, because it's...
Underwater, you're right, that's how you pronounce it. Yeah. here's a great Western that he made that doesn't get enough love. It has a lousy ending, but besides that, the film is fantastic. Last Train from Gun Hill.
Ooh.
Oh yeah, that is good.
It's got Kirk Douglas and Anthony Quinn.
Yeah, it's really good.
Anthony Quinn, who was supposed to star in The Magnificent Seven.
Yep.
He was supposed to star in it, and apparently he sued the movie for damages when he was written out. Because Quinn, he and Brenner saw Seven Samurai together because Quinn was directing Brenner. He took over the directing duties on The Buccaneer when Cecil B. DeMille got sick. DeMille was remaking his own movie like he did with The Ten Commandments. But in the middle of filming The Buccaneer, he got ill, and he got his son-in-law, Anthony Quinn, to finish it. It's the only movie Quinn directed. It stars Yul Brynner, and they watched Seven Samurai. They were pretty keen on remaking it, and the guy who's credited as associate producer on the movie is, I can't remember his name, but he had bought the rights to it, and basically Brynner picked up, like, kind of got to him, picked up the rights, and it was going to be Quinn and Brynner, but I think when John Sturges came on, I don't know what happened, but Quinn was basically out. I don't know if you have any other information on that, Eric or John.
I don't. Did you say The Buccaneer was it couldn't possibly be a remake of
it is. No. It was DeMille remaking his own movie.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I missed that. Okay.
No, yeah. DeMille did a film in the 30s with Frederick Marsh called The Buccaneer, which is about Jean Lafitte, the pirate from Louisiana and Texas. Brynner plays Lafitte in the remake of The Buccaneer.
He founded Galveston, right?
I believe so. And that he was also participated in the Battle of New Orleans, and which was Andrew Jackson's claim to fame. Charlton Heston plays Jackson in the remake of The Buccaneer.
And not a lot of movies about 1812. So.
No, although I got to say, The Buccaneer remake, I've seen it, and it's not very good. It has its moments, but the Battle of New Orleans is the least interesting thing in it.
Yeah.
It's really
mainly the scenes where they're trying to convince Jean Lafitte to participate, where Jackson's talking to him and stuff. That's the best stuff in the movie.
And I've seen the original too, and I didn't think it was that good either. The original, it might have had a little more Caribbean flavor because you didn't have those Technicolor sets that kind of, it feels like it's all shot in a studio in the remake. And Charlton Heston also looks like Andrew Jackson when he was president. So it looks like old Andrew Jackson, who was beating would-be assassins to death with a cane. not the man thirsty for British blood, Andrew Jackson.
It's interesting because it's a great story, and it would make a good Hollywood movie, but it never has. And if they made it now, they'd have all this terrible, you know, John Woo slow motion with musket rifles and stuff.
Yeah.
It's too bad. It's a great story. We need more, you know, positive historical films for the kids to see, but they don't do that no more.
No.
Raise your kids on the Vikings and all that. You got to raise them on stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So The Magnificent Seven stars, it's got some pretty big egos in there that were not really well known at the time. So you've got Yul Brynner, but you've also got Steve McQueen. You've got Charles Bronson. You've got Robert Vaughn. You've got James Coburn, and you have the guy playing the Toshiro Mifune role, Horst Buchholz.
Yes.
The young kid in the movie, which apparently was the role McQueen wanted, and didn't feel his, even though he has top billing in the movie, not top, Yul Brynner's top, but he's one of, you know, the big names on the poster. That was the role McQueen wanted, because it's a bigger role. But
and gets the role and stuff.
Yeah, but you've got a lot of big name, big ego dudes on this movie, and apparently there were some conflicts. Do you know anything about that, Eric?
Just most of the stuff everybody knows, where whenever McQueen and Brynner shared a scene or a shot in a scene, Brynner would usually do most of the talking because McQueen doesn't have a lot of lines. So McQueen would try to upstage him in the background by flipping around, playing around with his hat and stuff, so that the audience would just like dart to him and not even look at Yul Brynner. So things like that. And Brynner was not happy about it. In fact, he refused to star in the second one because initially they were getting Steve McQueen to be in it with him. Mm. And he did not want McQueen on it. But then McQueen went and made Sand Pebbles. And that's what he was doing in 1966 when The Return of the Magnificent Seven came out.
I heard even Bronson would do stuff to sort of stand out in scenes like, you know, oh, I'm going to get some water for my hat. When my horse comes.
Well, strangely, Bronson probably gets more character moments than McQueen does. I just saw it. That's what it came off like to me.
I'm going to tell you, Bronson has the best scenes in the movie.
He does. Absolutely.
He does. He really, really does.
He has all of the pro-family stuff, because I wrote this down, because I wrote, deeper than I recall, very pro-family. It's, you know, he's talking to the kids, and the kids are saying, oh, you know, you're a real hero, and our fathers are cowards compared to you, and because they won't stand up and fight. And Bronson has this long soliloquy about, like, oh, how dare you? He slaps him, you know.
No, he spanks him. He gets him over his knee and whips him.
Times, and he says, your father has responsibilities. He has to take care of you and your mother. And I've never taken up responsibilities like that. That's real courage, you know, things like that.
It's a great scene. That's my favorite scene in the film.
Great scene. Great scene. And to further it even more along, I think it's Robert Vaughn and Yul Brynner where they're discussing the pros of their degenerate lifestyle as gunfighters.
No, but that's the thing in this movie, though, is they're degenerates. That's the thing, is they're like, our lives are stupid. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's a pointless life. And the pros are very little compared to the cons. And I think, you know, they fall in love with the village and they get a taste of what family's like. They get a taste of having kids and, you know, actually having a real life that's important, having a legacy as opposed to dying in some dusty street and being forgotten about almost immediately after your death. And of course, the only one that seems to be interested in this lifestyle is the young kid, Buckholz, Chico. Yeah. You know, because he's got all the brashness of youth and stuff. And yeah, it's an interesting movie where it actually makes a, especially for 1960 Hollywood, where it makes a stance on, like, actually, this lifestyle is not cool.
Well, and you talked about Buchholz's character, Chico. You know, something they take from Seven Samurai is that the Toshiro Mifune character in Seven Samurai, his name is Kikuchiyo. He comes from that peasant class. And, you know, Japan had a caste system. But Chico comes from he's like the son of farmers. And he has this inferiority complex over it. And he wants to be this tough guy gunfighter. But at the end of the film, he embraces where he comes from. He embraces, he falls in love with the girl. He puts down roots and stays there while McQueen and the other gunfighters either die or just sort of go, you know, we helped out, but at the end of the day, we're still adrift. We're still God's lonely man, you know. I thought that was very interesting that the movie had these scenes where they talked about how real responsibility is parenthood. That's a weight like a boulder. You are responsible for someone else. We don't have that responsibility. It's very, very good stuff. And Bronson has those scenes, and they're meaty scenes. They're really good. And he kind of is this sort of surrogate. He's the guy these kids look up to, and it's great.
Did you realize how frank some of the dialogue was? Like, they make no bones about it when they find out that the villagers, when they arrive, they make comments about, like, why are there no women? Isn't that strange?
And they go, well, we're worried you would rape them. And Yul Brynner goes,
well, he said, maybe we would.
He goes, well, maybe, but we would appreciate the benefit of the doubt.
It might be the first time. Now, of course, I'm not one of these, movie history buffs who are prude and pretend that, that Hollywood didn't tackle these subjects pre, you know, 1950 or something. But, you know, Hollywood did mention, did have rape and all that. It was all alluded to. I think it might be, it's 1960. We're just right out of the 50s. I think it might be the first time that rape was actually mentioned.
Really?
Like rape, the word rape, like straight out, as opposed to just kind of playing footsie with it.
Yeah, it's implied in movies like Champion with Kirk Douglas, but it's never actually, I don't think they said anything. Well, they actually, maybe they did. Maybe they said something at the end of Champion. He said something like he was accused of being a rapist, or she said he raped me, or whatever. And it was just implied in the film. You know, you get the close up of Kirk's face and the swinging of a light bulb or whatever. You know, it's like,
well, in a lot of ways, the Hays Code really made movies sexier. And I'm not talking about rape is sexy. I'm just saying, I'm just saying that the Hays Code kind of made things a little sexier than having it just be what it is. Where I don't know what the film is, but the protagonist would kiss the woman all the way down to her neck, and then he goes off camera, and then this is like, where does he go? I mean, you know, that sort of thing.
You talked about rape. Yes. Another Kurosawa remake as a Western would deal with rape, and that's The Outrage.
The Outrage.
From 1964 with Paul Newman, directed by Martin Ritt, who was actually originally supposed to direct The Magnificent Seven before John Sturges came on. But it stars William Shatner and Paul Newman and Lawrence Harvey. But that was a remake of Rashomon.
Let me tell you what happened to me. I'll tell you my version of it. I've never seen it, but I imagine that's what it's like. This bandit came right out of the woods, raped my girl.
But yeah,
a lot of people forget it exists. A film professor friend of mine had it on DVD. I watched it ages ago.
Any good? I've never seen it.
Long before I saw Rashomon, actually. I remember enjoying it. I don't remember if it compares in any way to Rashomon. I would imagine it's shorter. So I think The Outrage was like 90 minutes.
Rashomon's pretty short. It's like 90 minutes, I think.
Is it also? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm getting it conflated with...
Well, it's because it's Kurosawa, you know. You go, oh, it must be long because it's Kurosawa.
Probably my favorite Kurosawa is Sanjuro. I like that better than the OG.
Yeah, Sanjuro's a blast. That's probably the best Kurosawa.
It's really good. Got the best, like, accidental blood splatter ever.
That and the damn 87th Precinct adaptation, High and Low. I think those are his two best movies.
High and Low
is really good. I like one that I think is underrated is The Bad Sleep Well. That was one that I remember liking a lot.
Haven't seen that one. I haven't seen Ran.
Ran's great.
It's great, but long. I like Throne of Blood quite a bit.
Throne of Blood's
great. I think it's a lot of fun.
Throne of Blood
and short. It's not that long.
It's not that long. And what kept me from Ran is the length, again.
Here's the thing is Ran, like, it's Kagemusha and Ran. Kagemusha is basically, I think Kurosawa called it a dress rehearsal for Ran, and that's correct. It's also a very long, epic movie, but Ran is very complete. It also stars Tatsuya Nakadai, who played the villain who gets slashed in that scene in Sanjuro. But yeah, and another Kurosawa one that I love, there's two Toshirô Mifune ones that I think are great. Drunken Angel, their first collaboration, which is a gangster movie. That's a really good film. And Redbeard, their final collaboration, is also very good.
Yeah, Redbeard's good.
Yeah.
That's also where Kurosawa started to get very Kubrick.
Yes. And I love
Redbeard. He was doing endless takes. He drove Mifune nuts with the constant overdirecting, and that led to their falling out.
Yes, it did. And I think Kurosawa's career kind of hit the skids after that. That's when he started doing stuff like Dodeskaden and became suicidal.
Yeah, he made a movie with the Soviets.
Oh, yeah, which is actually a pretty good movie, Der Suuzala.
Yeah.
It's a good movie. I recommend it, even though it's a Soviet
film. And I think
film.
Lucas and Coppola had to finance Kagemusha.
They did.
Originally it was supposed to star Shintaro Katsu, and he worked on it for a couple of days and then left the project.
Are you sure that was Kagemusha, not Ran? I thought it was Ran, but I could be wrong.
No, it was Kagemusha, and some Kurosawa fans have said Kagemusha could have used maybe a more humorous performance, and Katsu would have been better in the role, but they just couldn't get along. So.
I heard the reason Katsu and Kurosawa didn't get along was Katsu liked to bring in his own people to film his performances. And Kurosawa didn't like that, and so that they couldn't agree on that, and so that's what led to
You're talking about two egomaniacs.
Oh yeah, big time. those are two egos. There's not enough room on the set. Well, like, and that's the thing is there wasn't enough room on the set for Kurosawa and Mifune by the time they made Redbeard, you know.
Right. And Kurosawa's, you know, Mifune could get roles in American films easily. Like, he was considered a star in America. So.
He did Spielberg's 1941.
Mm-hmm. He auditioned for Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid. And would have probably played the role if Eastwood had directed it.
Didn't he do that spaghetti, not spaghetti western, it's an American western, but with Terrence Young directed it.
Red Sun.
Yeah,
Red Sun. It's a Euro Western, I think. They were shot in Spain.
And he did a film. He did a Zatoichi movie with Katsu. Zatoichi meets Yojimbo.
Yes, he did. Zatoichi meets Yojimbo. And also, it's not the best of the series. Has a good soundtrack, though. He did. He was friends with Frankenheimer, so he did John Frankenheimer movies, like the race car thing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's crazy. I forgot about that. But anyway, we're far away from Magnificent Seven.
Right.
So, Eric, you said you had a Bugman list for this. What is your
My Bugman list actually pertains to the sequel, the first one.
Oh, well, okay. Let's save that. Robert Vaughn. Okay, John, I don't know much about Man from U.N.C.L.E., but I know you guys are bigger fans of that. At least I know John is. I don't know about you, Eric. But he's kind of the big star in this movie that I don't know as much about. Was this before or after that?
Mm-hmm. This is before.
Yeah, it was before Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Okay.
Yeah,
he was not much of a name. I think he'd been in stuff like Teenage Caveman and everything, but he was another star on the rise. And one thing you have to remember is Magnificent Seven was not a hit in America when it was first released. It was not until those guys were stars later, and it wasn't because of this. Like, they became bigger stars a few years later, and then it was re-released and was a smash hit. Then they had to do the sequels.
I heard that this movie also played a lot on television.
Yeah.
Like, it was a big TV
staple. Yeah, I saw it on WGN, I think, in 1983, like, on a Friday night. It was, like, the Friday night movie. They'd always show something with Bronson. Like, there had to be a movie with Charles Bronson on every week on WGN because he was that big of a star on cable TV. And they showed The Magnificent Seven. That's where I first saw it. And I would watch it every 10 years, you know, in a different format, like watch it in Laserdisc, then watch it on DVD, like as I have done now. I won't watch it on streaming because the Starz print is Zoom boxed, I think.
Man, yeah, those streaming service prints are not created equal.
Oh, Enter the Dragon is Zoom boxed on Netflix. I was stunned.
Wow. You got to get that Criterion set, fam. You know?
Yeah,
that's
apparently.
I don't know how many times I've bought the Bruce Lee ones, but the Criterion
you
set...
You think you don't know how many times? I'm older than you.
Yeah, I know.
How many times I bought those fucking things?
I'm waiting for July to roll around.
Yeah, same here. I'm going to get it.
Oh, man.
You're talking about since the 80s.
Yeah.
When I was actually thinking about paying $50 for Chinese Connection because it's how much it costs.
Now you can get the Criterion set during the Barnes & Noble sale for that much.
For about $50. High def prints, including the best movie of the set, Tower of Death, Game of Death 2. The only one I'll actually watch.
That's the best one, yeah.
Yes, it is.
So out of the seven, Brad Dexter is the one that gets robbed.
Yeah, he's the one that you don't see on the poster.
Well, you don't
like,
barely
he was
see him.
He was a Rat Pack lackey. I think he was like a Frank Sinatra pal that got the role.
That has to be true because I just looked him up and he's in Johnny Cool, and that's just a Rat Pack movie, basically.
Yeah,
he was one of those Rat Pack guys.
But McQueen wasn't a big star yet either, was he?
No, he wasn't. And
Yul Brynner was the only big star in this.
And Eli Wallach was famous on stage. Like, he was kind of a Broadway guy, right?
Famous on stage, I think got a push for Baby Doll.
Yes, with Elia Kazan. So he was one of those cutting-edge actors if he was working with Kazan. You know, that was like method, early method, like Strasberg, you know. But speaking of, you know, I talked about Yul Brynner's reputation in Westerns. Eric, what do you think about Steve McQueen as a Western star?
I thought you were going to say, what do you think about Brad Dexter? I was like,
What do you think about Brad Dexter as a Western star?
I can't.
Brad Dexter. And
Eric,
Westerns.
Eric, you didn't come prepared to talk about Brad Dexter?
Talking about Brad Dexter here tonight, Eric.
Eric, what's Dexter. Wrong with you? Why
that,
aren't you?
That
why
Dexter did... Western thing going on.
Brad Dexter killed my wife.
I know what I'd call a movie starring Brad Dexter. Box office poison.
Steve McQueen is a Western star. Well, I think he probably has more going on than Yul Brynner because you got Wanted Dead or Alive and for television, and after that it's Mag 7.
Junior Bonner.
That's right, Junior Bonner does. But was that a hit for
Peckinpah? No, I don't think so.
No. Nevada Smith,
which I was so I remember watching. The Nevada Smith is a spinoff of what's the name of the film?
Carpetbaggers.
I remember watching Carpetbaggers late one night, and there's this old guy that comes in because it takes place in the 20s or the 30s, and there's this old guy that comes in calling himself Nevada Smith. He's got like cowboy boots, and he's clearly like a guy from the period 30 years ago. And I'm like, that's strange, Nevada Smith, huh? Steve McQueen played a guy named Nevada Smith. And then I looked it up and I'm like, oh shit, it's a spinoff where they have the younger years of Nevada Smith. But Nevada Smith, I don't think anybody gives a flying fuck about Nevada Smith, to be honest with you. I don't think anyone really cares all that much about Tom Horn, but it's got its fans, and I'm one of them. I like Tom Horn. And that's about it for his Western career, really, like the stuff that people know.
What do you think of his other ensemble film with Sturges, The Great Escape?
Escape, it's better than this.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
And I say that because knowing that it's longer, so usually wouldn't mean no, but it's better than this.
I've heard that Donald Pleasance was in, he was in a POW camp in World War II. And,
what?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Donald Pleasance.
Donald Pleasance. I was thinking Sutherland. I was just like, that
no,
guy?
No. Well, okay, yes, yes, I drew on those experiences from
that. He was 5 years old at the time and Canadian.
Yeah, so no, it didn't make any sense.
I need to get age up here.
But I heard that he would go up to John Sturges and go, yeah, you know, I could give you some pointers on this scene because, you know, I actually have experience with it. And John Sturges would kind of just go like, yeah, whatever, okay. And then somebody went up to Sturges and went, you know, he was in a POW camp. And he went, oh, really? Like, but at first, like, he was Pleasance would come up to him and give him advice, and he would just ignore him. Like, he would just blow him off. Like, okay, sure, whatever, pal. And somebody just pulled him aside and went, no, he's a real POW. Like,
get this midget out of my face.
It's like, you know, there's things you can do differently.
All he does is scream about Michael Myers. What do I...
Yes.
But that one also had Coburn in it.
Yes, it did.
And Coburn was, you know, he wasn't a big star yet at the time.
And Bronson.
Bronson either. And in fact, Bronson is in The Great Escape. And during this time period, you know, I think of Bronson as being an ensemble guy before becoming a star later. But Coburn... Eric, what do you think about his Western track record?
James Coburn. He's in my favorite Leone Western.
Fistful of Dynamite?
That's correct.
That's your favorite Leone Western, really?
It's the one that's the most underplayed, and I think it is certainly the first time Leone tried actual real character stuff, development. So I think he's out of his element a little bit, but I'm glad that he tried. So,
was it? Okay.
Hunter, we're all saying that now. All the old Leone fans are saying Fistful of Dynamite's the only one we can sit through now.
Well, yeah, because we've seen the others.
We OD'd on these damn things.
Yeah,
years ago.
It's the one you guys haven't watched to death yet. I heard, Eric, I read this on the internet and I didn't believe it. And so maybe you can confirm this for me. I read that Peter Bogdanovich was supposed to direct that movie.
Yes.
That's true? That's true? Really?
Yes, it is.
Bogdanovich, of all people?
That's true. Leone had, at that time, had enough clout. Where he was, especially with the movie brats, he was, you know, the movie brats were big fans of him.
Oh yeah,
and that is true. And eventually, it went to when Bogdanovich bailed, it went to Giancarlo Santi, who ended up being the second unit after Rod Steiger found out that Santi was not Leone, and he made a big.
He just comes up to him. My name is Sergio Leone. And he's like, I just don't know any better because I'm Rod Steiger.
Yeah.
I'm not Italian.
Exactly. He found out like day 10 or something.
Supposedly Coburn and Steiger like refused to work or something until Leone came down from his house.
I can see that happening in Japan. It's like Toho's like, these guys, they think they're working on a Kurosawa film. Just send out some Japanese nobody and tell them it's Kurosawa.
Probably happened to Nick Adams a few times.
Like, just tell Raymond Burr he's working with Kurosawa, okay?
Hunter, all the Raymond Burr stuff was shot in L.A., you know that.
I know.
Nick Adams actually went over there and made movies, and so did, his name, from War of the Gargantulas. Russ, whatever his name is.
Russ Tamblyn.
Just tell Russ Tamblyn he's working with Kurosawa, okay?
Yes. He's stoned, he won't know the difference.
But Coburn's Westerns, very few leading roles. You know, he shows up in Ride Lonesome, which is a great film.
That's a great movie. But Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, what about that one?
That is a 70s haze dream. Is that barely a
film? Yeah, it's not really a Western.
Yeah, that's barely a film. That is a series of stuff that a drunken man put together.
It really is. Yes. It's
drunk,
like,
and possibly on cocaine.
On coke, yeah.
Like Chris Christopherson, James Coburn, Sam Penn, they're all hammered. And they're all like, I think this is this Billy the Kid?
God, everybody looks stoned in the film. It's just, I watched it recently and I was like, what the hell are they making?
That is a movie, though, that was revered by, like, film fans for a while. Like, they thought, because the editing is so weird in it, you know, it just had this Peckinpah
was a hero to those guys. He was a big hero to all of them. Even when he made shitty movies, they found all these nice things to say about the crap films.
What about Maverick? What about Maverick?
I've never seen it. Don't really care that much.
But it's got Mel Gibson in it. Come on.
Yeah,
it's Richard Donner.
It's but like also Gibson. Like I like Gibson when he's in his Mad Mel phase. So we're 20 years off that with Maverick.
Frankly, Richard Donner sucks. Come on.
Alice Cooper was going to have a cameo in it. I think they shot it and everything, but it didn't make the cut.
You know what's another Peckinpah Western with Coburn is Major Dundee, starring Charlton Heston.
I like Major Dundee more than I like Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Me too.
I don't despise Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. I think parts of it work.
Yeah, it has great scenes. Major Dundee was actually the first Peckinpah film I saw, and I saw it in the theater in 1965. Just kidding. No, I saw it in like a special screening. There was like some revival screening of it.
Dundee is underrated.
Yeah,
It is underrated. I think the only Peckinpah movie I've yet to watch because I can't get through the first 10 minutes is Deadly Companions.
Never seen it.
It's tough.
But Major Dundee is about to get a Blu-ray release from Arrow. So it's going on the Arrow show.
Interesting.
Grabbing that.
Yeah.
Coburn Westerns. Reason to Live, Reason to Die.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's okay.
I like it!
Okay, all right. All right. No, I mean, I'd get it, especially if it's the unrated cut with all the F-words thrown in.
Yeah. You're talking about the movie with Telly, right? Is he in that? Yeah.
Telly's in it. He's the villain.
Yeah. And the Confederate fort is a European castle.
Yep. Occasionally, castles will seep in. At least the Confederate fort, it looks like a fort, at least. At the very least. But sometimes, if you go into, like, Z-grade spaghetti westerns, occasionally you will fucking see a castle in the background. Just didn't care.
But that Confederate fort in A Reason to Live, A Reason to Die, which I like a lot, movie I like a lot, is that is a European thing. If they had set it in Mexico, I would go, okay, maybe. But just that being in the South, no.
I saw The Last of the Hard Men, where Coburn is the villain. It's a late period Western with Charlton Heston in it. I saw that, and I liked it because I think it was kind of edgy. So I don't know if I'd really get too much into it now. Nobody's seen Last of the Hard Men?
Nope. Never seen it.
I saw it when I was a kid on network TV, like cut to bits, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, because it's a pretty harrowing movie. Great cast. You got Charlton Heston, you got James Coburn, you got what's-his-face, Bronson is coming, or When Bronson Came, TV show, he died, Michael Parks.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Parks, you got Barbara Hershey, and you got Hunter's favorite, Chris Mitchum.
Oh, yeah, I love Chris. Yeah, he's the coolest.
Love
him. Draw the TV movie with Kirk Douglas and James Coburn.
Oh, never seen it.
It was made for HBO and shot in Canada, and it's just kind of like an amusing comedy. It's funnier than Rustler's Rhapsody, but that's all you can
do. Is it funnier than Waterhole Number 3?
Possibly. I could never get through Waterhole Number 3.
Why would anybody?
I have never finished watching Waterhole Number 3, but I'm going to do it one of these days. I am going to watch the whole damn thing.
I think you will be the Neil Armstrong of Waterhole Number 3 if you finish it.
Still going to finish the damn thing.
The
thing is, boomers love that movie.
Do they really?
Yes.
Another reason to hate boomers.
It was a huge hit in the 67.
Another reason to hate boomers. I don't believe it. I think James Coburn was riding high, and then everybody fell asleep halfway through. I don't believe it.
No, Eric.
Everybody just went to go
see that movie.
Wait, it's got Timothy Carey in it. That means I have to watch it. Just kidding.
67, the boomers went in to smoke some dope, and they conked out half an hour in.
Well, I have often said that James Coburn he rivals Burt Reynolds as the coolest, most likable actor who stars in more garbage than any other actor.
That's true.
He does rival Burt. I really think he does.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Burt, I think Burt's highs are stronger than Coburn's highs.
Yeah. It's like the Flint movies. We did the Flint movies and we wanted them to be so much better because James Coburn's so cool.
They're cheap.
But they're not that good.
Yeah.
No.
Have any of you seen another Peckinpah movie he was in, Cross of Iron? Any of you seen that?
Yes.
It's good.
I've heard it's really good.
That's one of the best Peckinpahs. Actually really underrated.
Especially in the later period, definitely.
And a rare Eastern Front World War II movie.
So. Yes.
Yeah, the Germans are the protagonists.
Yes. You got to root for the Germans.
You know what I've been getting into lately? I was talking to John about this. Enemy Ace. Those Enemy Ace comics, of course, are different wars. World War One. It's a dogfight comic book. And it's the protagonist is the kind of Red Baron kind of character. It's German. I'll endorse it. It's very good dogfight stuff. And considering how superstitious all these pilots were, I can imagine that the stuff that goes on in the comic books probably is some historical basis where guys are dressed up as skeletons and hangmen and stuff.
So you want to talk about Bite the Bullet?
I really don't.
Okay, let's talk about Bite the Bullet.
It's James Coburn's in it. It's basically, from what I remember, a rat race, or it's a mad world type movie without the comedy. Without the comedy, I should say. So, Wild West version of that. Not good, because you wanted to talk about James Coburn westerns, and it's becoming apparent that not a lot of them are any good.
Well, you know, we're just exploring the career of the cast, my man. You know,
that's right. Yeah. He's
thought of as a Western star, but there's hardly anything there.
Yeah.
Just like Steve McQueen.
And Yul Brynner.
Yul Brynner, yeah.
Misremembered.
Yeah. It's made up of a bunch of actors as known as Western stars, but really they're not.
A guy who is, I don't think of as a Western star, is Charles Bronson. Now, he has some big, big names in his career, like Once Upon a Time in the West. He's been in a few Westerns.
It's been, you know, like nobody remembers how successful it was now, but Red Sun was a huge hit.
Red Sun with Toshiro Mifune.
Yeah, he definitely has a lot more recognizable Westerns to his name than any of the guys we're talking about now.
So what about
Breakheart Pass?
Yeah. Breakheart Pass, Chato's land.
Hey, this is Chato. I'm Chato. Get off my land.
Yeah. Chato's land.
Even stuff that like people half remember, maybe or not at all, is the quality is still there. White Buffalo. I like the first 45 minutes of that. From Noon Till Three is surprisingly good.
There's a few. He's a villainous Indian in Anthony Quinn Western, Spaghetti Western, Guns for San Sebastian.
Yeah. A lot of character actor days. I believe Vera Cruz, which is a great movie. And is somewhat connected to Magnificent Seven, because I seem to recall the pressure from the Mexican government they shot in Mexico. They wanted to make all the peons look really clean. That's why they're like wearing white, and there's not like a speck of dust on them. That was directly because, I believe, of Vera Cruz, which made Mexico look like an unholy piece of shit.
Yeah, Vera Cruz.
How could they?
Vera Cruz made Mexico. Mexico was really angry over that film. And so when they shot this movie, they had a guy on set who was a censor. One of the big changes to the plot they had to do to please the Mexican government was the farmers, instead of going to look for gunmen, they went to look for guns, because they didn't want to make the farmers seem like they were completely inept. And then Yul Brynner goes, guns are expensive. Why not get men? They're cheaper. That was a change at the behest of the Mexican government, excuse me.
And Vera Cruz just makes that country look like hell on earth, which, you know.
You know, well, what can you do?
Yeah, I won't say any more about that.
You know what's a good Western with Charles Bronson? He's not a star of it, but Jubal, the Delmer Davies film.
I own it on Criterion just because it's a Western. I'll watch it again. I wasn't
good
super
movie.
Keen.
I like it. It's good.
Vila Rides is good, or Via Rides, I should say. There's one with Randolph Scott. I want to say it's Riding Shotgun.
Yes.
That's pretty good. And I believe he's a bad guy in that.
And he's credited as Charles Baczynski.
Baczynski.
Yes, he was Baczynski for early on.
That wasn't Bedeker. That was it. Oh, did you say it was just Randolph Scott? You didn't say it was Bedeker.
It's just Randy Scott. It's one of his better non-Bedeker ones.
Because it was Andre de Toth who did Day of the Outlaw.
It may very well be Andre de Toth. Let me look it up. I'm going to look it up now. It is. It's Andre de Toth. He did de Toth did another one with Scott that I've seen. It was in 3D originally. It was one of the early 50s 3D movies, Bounty Hunter.
De Toth was a big 3D guy because he did the Wax Museum with Vincent Price.
Yeah.
Which is a 3D movie.
Yeah, more so than we think. Wax Museum, Bounty Hunter. Did you know that I, the Jury from 50 Whenever was a 3D movie?
I did not know. But John did.
Yeah, Elroy was trying to get it for his Alamo series, but was not successful because of the 3D thing. They didn't have a print.
You don't have the two projectors. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it was going to be tough.
You know what's a great movie with Charles Bronson? Kid Galahad with Elvis Presley.
I've seen it. It's for me, it's one of the mediocre presents. Yeah, you were joking.
I'm just joking.
I like the Presley movies. I like. Want to do that?
I do like Presley movies.
Aren't we grasping for straws here in our Magnificent Seven?
Okay. Well, we can move on. Let's move on to another topic.
All right. I was going to give the top five for Elvis, but that's fine.
We'll okay. Give your top five for Elvis. I want to hear it.
It's probably not much different from everybody else's top five. It's King
it's always
Creole.
The same.
Yeah, let's move on.
King Creole, Viva Las Vegas, Flaming Star. Yeah.
Flaming Star, you know.
And then you got to leave room for a bad one just to throw people off. So you say, sure. Oh, change of habit.
I like Tickle Me. How about that?
Tickle Me, there you go. you could put Jailhouse Rock in there.
Yeah, Jailhouse, that's often considered one of the better ones, and it is, but it's nowhere near in the same class as King Creole or any of the ones we just talked
about. The thing about Jailhouse Rock is it's good for its musical sequences. The plot is junk.
Mm-hmm.
But King Creole, you have, and Flaming Star, you have more of a complete package with those movies and Viva Las Vegas and stuff like that.
Viva Las Vegas is the best of the silly ones.
Yes. And it's got, what's her name? Anne Margaret.
Oh, Anne Margaret.
Anne Margaret. You got a Death Race 2000 situation at the end where people are just getting murdered on the road.
That's where Speed Racer was stolen from. Totally. That entire end sequence is Speed Racer. That's the Speed Racer cartoon.
Probably right. The European guy that he goes up against, I forget what nationality he is, but like he clearly dies on the road during the race, but he's, you know, they have to throw in that he's still alive. He's okay. I mean, there's nobody coming back from that car crash. It's a wreck.
But so with Magnificent Seven, I want to talk about the stuff that came after. But let's talk about, you know, what we thought of the movie itself, what we think of it as a movie, as a guys on a mission movie. Eric, you're the guest. You go first.
I've seen it three times now, maybe. Maybe twice. I don't remember.
My second time watching it.
I saw it once, probably during high school. I didn't think too much of it. I thought it had an inflated legacy, and to this day I still think that after watching it again. However, it did work for me a lot better than it did the first time, or maybe the first two times, for the reasons I stated earlier. It has some really interesting subjects. There's a lot of good character stuff that I missed out on the first time. It's a good movie. It's always been a good movie. I don't think it deserves the legacy that it does, and I think it's brought on by the amount of cool people that are in the cast, more so than the quality of the film.
John, what about you?
This is probably my fourth or fifth time watching it, and it gets better for me every time I watch it, because I start to see more of the character stuff and start to remember, oh, that's how they twisted that from Kurosawa. And this time when I watched it, it was inspired by the Russian kettlebell trainer Pavel Tsitsulin was on Joe Rogan's show. He had said that when he was a kid, his dad took him to see Magnificent Seven because it played theaters in Ukraine when he was a kid. And it was Soviet Union back then. But he said that to him, it was a movie about American exceptionalism. And I had not seen the film through that prism, that's what it's about. That's how he viewed it. And so I told my son, I said, well, we're going to watch Magnificent Seven, because he was asking me, like, what is American exceptionalism? I said, well, supposedly it's in Magnificent Seven. So we watched it one Saturday morning a few weeks ago, and I was totally blown away seeing it from that perspective.
Hmm.
So I was like, oh, wow, it really is. Because there's a scene, you know, where they're driven from the village and they're
they're tossed their guns and told to ride on, and they say, we're going back in because nobody throws my gun at me and says leave or something, or ride on. So there's this, there's a lot to read in between the lines there that's in the script that you don't get out of anything today. You're not going to get it out of John Wick or anything like that. I started to see it on a different perspective that way, and it's probably the, I would say this viewing was the highest opinion I've had of it.
I loved it the first time I watched it. This time I wasn't as into it, but I still really liked it. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I think the thing I really noticed more was the deeper things in the script. Like you said, Eric, the pro-family messaging. I thought the stuff with Bronson telling the kids about how brave their dads are. You know, the stuff in Seven Samurai that always jumps out to me when I watch it is how the real big arc, the character arc in the film, is the villagers. In Seven Samurai, the villagers go from being completely, almost like pathetic worms. You almost kind of hate them at times. And that this movie has that too. At the end of Seven Samurai, the villagers sort of realize that they can stand up for themselves. And by the end, they're celebrating. And the samurai are kind of lonely. And, you know, they realize that they kind of, yes, this is a victory for them, but what do we have? We don't have anything. And that's in this movie. But this movie also hits home. The villagers seem less pathetic because they do have responsibility. The movie constantly reminds you that they have kids, they have wives, they have family, they have all these things to consider that the gunmen don't. And I thought that was very interesting.
Well, one thing I want to mention is Robert Vaughn may be the first character I've seen in a Western that seems to suffer from PTSD.
Yes. Oh, yeah, big time. Yeah,
and
that's a great point.
I don't know how often that was addressed in movies at the time, but, you know, I know that was an issue for soldiers coming back from World War II in Korea.
Yeah, I actually was shocked about that scene, and I forgot about it until you mentioned it. But, yeah, it's a very interesting that they included that in 1960.
Yeah.
Maybe
and
Vietnam had something to do with
the
that.
West is dying, you know, and that's about it.
Oh no, Vietnam was late 60s, excuse me. Yeah, the West.
Yeah, yeah, it was a couple of years later Kennedy started sending the troops in.
Yeah, so Korea would have been the most recent thing.
There is some West is dying stuff, even though it seems to not be in that realm. Obviously it's not in the 20th century. It's probably set during the same period as most Westerns, which is like the 1880s. But yeah, there's often talk of, you know, gunmen come cheaper now these days because, you know, the West has just become more tame. So there's less and less need for guys like that. There's little bits and pieces of that all throughout the film.
And Seven Samurai has the same talk in it.
Yeah, but yeah, the villagers grow, the gunmen grow as people, even though they still basically miss out at the end. And they remain being who they are, but they come away with it with a different perspective. I think next time I watch it, it'll be after I rewatch Seven Samurai. It'll probably be a more enriching viewing after that.
Seven Samurai, and again, it's been a minute since I've watched Seven Samurai, so I don't know if it has the stuff that Bronson talks about family and stuff like that, but yeah, this made me want to go back and watch Seven Samurai again. It's sitting up there, it's at the top of the Criterion shelf. It's the first thing in there.
It makes me want to dig up the English dub because I know it's out there somewhere.
Yeah, it needs to be restored. We're talking about restoring the Snyderverse. Restore the Seven Samurai.
Restore
dub.
The English dub. Seven Samurai.
Before we move on to like sequels and the stuff that comes after this film, one thing I noticed was I was watching the Blu-ray of this, and the features that are on it were clearly produced for the DVD.
Yes.
Something that hit me very hard while watching the making of documentary on this, which was clearly produced for the DVD, was how long DVD's been around. Because the DVD has interviews with Coburn, it has interviews with Wallach, it has interviews with Elmer Bernstein. And I was thinking, boy, I remember when I first bought DVDs, I would see interviews with these guys, and they're all dead now.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how DVD hit when we still could get interviews with these guys. And even John Sturges did some commentaries on Laserdisc. So, and the commentary track, there's a commentary track that has Wallach and some other people. That was just something that struck me this time around, was seeing how involved a lot of the people were who were in the film with the DVD, when, you know, you just don't get that today. We have to, with these older movies, we have to rely on experts, you know.
Well, Wallach survived past Blu-ray's time. He died in 2014.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I was taken aback when my Winchester 73 DVD had a commentary from James Stewart. It was because it was taken off of the Laserdisc.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. Well, you see here, what we did here was we dressed up Rock like an Indian, see? You know, we said Rock.
Then I voted for Goldwater.
You saw, I said, Rock, hurry up. We got to do this scene. I got to go vote for Barry down at the thing. And then I got to go invest in oil companies and do my pro-oil movie with Anthony Mann, you know. Eric,
yes.
I have never seen the Magnificent Seven sequels. What Good. Say you? Because we've
seen Keep it that way, Hunter.
Yeah. Trust me.
There's Good. A bunch of them.
There's three films, three sequels, and a TV show, and a remake. I did not see the Anton Fuqua remake. I'm sorry.
There's Return of the Seven. Guns Only so much of the Magnificent you me do. Seven, and the Magnificent Return Seven. Of the Seven.
Yes, Return of the Seven, Guns of the Seven, Guns of the Magnificent Seven, and Magnificent Seven Ride. Correct.
Yep.
I have owned the fourth one, the third sequel, Magnificent Seven Ride, starring Lee Van Cleef in the Yul Brynner role. We discussed that earlier. I've owned that for years. I think I've seen it at least twice. I had never seen the middle sequels. I never saw Return, and I never saw Guns. So I rectified that this afternoon. And I have a list here of things that I thought about them. I enjoyed Return more than I enjoyed Guns. Return is actually not terrible.
It's written by Larry Cohen, right?
It is, and I'm going to talk about that. It feels trashier than the first one.
You don't say!
Yeah. For example, money isn't discussed at all when they get recruited for the mission or the objective to defend the once again, it's the same plot. They're defending the same village, actually. They're defending the same village from a band of mean old Mexicans.
Kind of undercuts the whole plot arc.
It sure does. I'm going to talk about that as well in a moment. But yes, it's so money isn't discussed, whereas in the first movie, money is the first thing on everybody's mind. How much you paying? It's like, well, it's just room and board. And a lot of the times they're just like, to hell with this. And then they come back later because they got nothing else much going on anyway. And, well, Brad Dexter gets kind of he bamboozles himself into it. He's just like, there's a silver mine, right? You're not telling me about. And, well, this time money doesn't seem to be on anybody's mind. First of all, two of the seven are condemned men that Chris gets out of prison. So they have no choice but to go. But everybody else goes in for very Larry Cohen-esque reasons. For instance, Warren Oates, who's one of the seven in this, he goes just because he finds out. The plot of the movie is that Mexicans, bad guys, show up to the Mexican village and take all the men for reasons that we don't find out till about the 50-minute mark. So the women are left there alone. And so a young kid that remembers Chris and the gang from 10 years prior goes to look for Chris. And yada, yada, yada. So Warren Oates is enlisted just because he wants to get in on all the women that are left away from their husbands. He just goes for lecherous purposes. That's his reason for joining the gang. But anyways, other things I noticed. I got a Bugman list here that I talked about earlier. You ready for the Bugman?
But Eric.
Yes.
I want you to hold your mouth open while you...
We did this last time.
Yeah, I know. I want to reiterate that I want you to do soy face. While
I'm gonna attempt it.
You have to go.
So the film was shot in Spain, right? Guns as well was shot in Spain. Ride, the fourth one, was shot entirely in the U.S. The only one of the four that was. So this one was shot in Spain, so naturally you're going to get a lot of Spanish actors from Italian Westerns, and one of the ones I recognized was Ricardo Palacios. It's this big fat guy, and he plays a jailer, a brief role. And the Bugman observation on that is Palacios was in two Italian Westerns with seven, the number seven in the title. Okay, there's The Vengeance of Pancho Villa, a.k.a. The Seven of Pancho Villa from the year later, 1967. And you got Up the McGregors, aka Seven Women for the McGregors, which is a sequel to Seven Guns for the McGregors. That's the end of my Bugman list. But I do have some observations from the sequel. It seems that it undermines the pro-family message of the first movie, in that the villain is like this sadistic dad who drove his two sons to suicide because they weren't manly enough for him.
Right? Which movie is this?
This is the second one, Return of the Seven.
Okay, I'm gonna stop you right there. I know why that's in there, and that's because Larry Cohen hates the family.
There you go.
He has made several films that are abortion propaganda movies. I think Bone is one. I've never seen it, but I remember him describing in an interview that Bone is a pro-abortion movie. Mm-hmm. He's described the It's Alive movies as pro-abortion movies. They're movies where a woman has a baby, the baby is a monster. And he goes, the message of those films is that abortion is good.
Where does that leave Q, the winged serpent?
That is a pro-lizard god kills nude sunbathers movie.
Okay, so a little less degenerate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Even though I am a fan of some of Larry Cohen's movies, there are a handful of his movies I am not a fan of for very specific reasons. And
he's made a lot of garbage. Yeah, everybody forgets. He gets fired from movies for a reason.
He's not that
skilled. He's an idea man. That's all he is.
I like Black Caesar. I liked Phone Booth. You know, I liked The Stuff. You know, but It's Alive. If you're making abortion propaganda movies, you probably are not a fan of the family.
Well, Hell Up in Harlem is a cheap piece of trash, but it's fun. I remember that.
Yeah,
being
I never
fun.
Saw that one. I loved Black Caesar, but I started Hell Up in Harlem and I couldn't get into it. But I need to give it another shot.
It's a one and done, but it's a fun little action film. So okay, I'm not surprised that this New York degenerate did this now. But yes, the villain, as I said, is a sadistic dad drove his sons to suicide. And Chico, who's played by a different actor this time, Horst Buchholz, for some reason did not reprise his role. Chico misses his old like rapscallion life as a drunk gunfighter, and is thinking of leaving his wife of 10 years. He eventually does not do that. At the end of the movie, there's a throwaway line where he says, "I've changed my mind." So it's like a Martin Scorsese movie where it's just like, oh, you like banging Margot Robbie on this yacht and being degenerate and doing all sorts of drugs? Well, guess what? The last 10 minutes of the movie, that's bad, and you're terrible for thinking you want to do that.
John,
mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about this next week.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I've never seen Wolves of Wall Street.
Oh, really?
Yeah, never seen it.
Okay, well, you know, if you want to do some extra homework for next week's show, watch it.
It's bad enough I had to find a torrent of the other film we're reviewing.
Yeah. But yes, Martin Scorsese, though, you say he does that with his movies. He does that with his gangster movies, too.
Goodfellas and Casino. It's a shell game that he plays. He glamorizes the life, and then the last 10 minutes, oh, it's terrible. How awful for you to think this was. Yeah, it's dishonest, and I don't like it. You know, it's a shampoo commercial for 2.5 hours, and then, the other shoe's going to drop now.
I said,
it's great until Pesci gets stabbed, which happens, I think, both in Goodfellas and Casino.
Yeah. Pesci gets his clot cleaned in both of those.
Yeah.
There's a reason rappers love Scarface. Yeah, at the end of Scarface, he does the right thing, and it gets him killed, but it looks awesome.
And arguably, I mean, not to get 1930s Hollywood off the hook, because, talk about a great era of movies, better than certainly now and for a long time, but all those gangster movies were exactly the same way.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's and the censors knew that. Yeah. The censors knew that the movies were bad. They recognized that when they saw a movie like Scarface, they recognized it was glorifying criminality. You know, these people weren't stupid.
Yeah. What makes Public Enemy and Roaring Twenties better than a Scorsese movie is that it's only a compact 90 minutes. You know, it's great. As opposed to, 6 hours.
And you don't have Derek of the Dominoes played for like 10 minutes.
Yeah. No. Oh my God. Yeah.
So, the sequels, you watched Guns. I mean, you watched, not Guns, I'm sorry. You watched Return.
I watched all of them.
You watched all of them.
Return is perfectly okay, minus the picadillos I had with the family stuff. Mm-hmm. Guns is demonstrably a lesser film. It's got George Kennedy in the Yul Brynner role.
Not a step up.
Yeah. Yeah. So you got like fat George Kennedy doing all this action stuff. And, you know, they got him for that role
with
because
his Basset Hound face.
Yeah. Like he was riding high at the time because he got he won an Oscar for Cool Hand Luke. And they read the tea leaves wrong there. And they were like, let's get this guy as a leading man. And yeah, no, that didn't take. So, you know, and I like George Kennedy, but not as a lead in your action picture.
Not in this, yeah.
No. Guns, not really all that much to say about it, except it finally embraces the Zapata Western territory all these movies want to get into. They're fighting Federales this time. But the one thing that I wrote down about Guns, which was not in the film at all, but HBO Max, where I watch these films with the Stars add-on, they have the rating at the beginning of the film, as you've seen many, many times for like 20 years now. Before they show a movie, they tell you what the rating is and why it's that rating. Guns of the Magnificent Seven, I wrote this down, I thought you'd like it, is rated PG for AC. AC stands for adult content. Okay. V stands for violence. Great. Could you tell me, this is brand spanking new and I know it is, could you tell me what OC is? Could you guess? I'll give you 5 seconds.
Original content.
Well, it would fail there, too. OC stands for Outdated Cultural Depiction.
What?
And I watched the movie. And so I suppose it's outdated to think that 1880s or 1890s Mexico wasn't a complete hellhole.
Let me tell you, I watched some of the remake from 2016.
Mm. Okay.
And it is rated, what is it rated?
PG-13.
Do you know what one of the things on the rating for PG-13 was?
I would guess smoking or drinking. Yes.
Smoking, John, but it did not say smoking. It said historical smoking.
I saw that on the back. I saw that same rating on the back of another PG-13 movie called The Monuments Men. Remember that World War II?
Yeah.
When I read that, I thought, is Sir Walter Raleigh going to fucking show up here? What do you mean historical smoking?
Historical smoking. Have any of you seen The Magnificent Seven? Okay, well, before we get to that, Eric, what about Magnificent Seven Ride?
Magnificent Seven Ride, I think I like more. Certainly, I like more than Guns. I thought Guns was pretty much the
worth watching because I want to know because it has Lee Van Cleef, and I feel obligated to watch it because it has Lee Van Cleef.
The short answer is no.
Okay. I'm glad to know this is going to save me a lot of time. So
yeah, the long answer is it has Lee Van Cleef in it. It's not terrible, but it's not good either. You can put it on and fall asleep or something. It's fine. It also has Lucas Skew, who's one of my favorite character actors. There is something to be said about Magnificent Seven Rides, actually. It adds to the formula a little bit, although they did flirt with it in return. All of the men in Rides are condemned men that Chris gets out of prison.
So it's like Dirty Dozen or something?
It's post-Dirty Dozen, so yeah, definitely. It's Dirty Dozen. So all these guys are terrible. At the end, when they kill all the bad guys, the town is just left with all these women. All the men are dead, with the exception of a few of the seven. Lucas Skew, I believe being the pervy one of the group, grabs two women and says, I'm a Mormon now.
Perfect.
Did Larry Cohen write that one too?
I don't think he did.
No, oh, okay. Arthur Rowe.
And Norman Lear.
Archie Bunker just showed up.
Mitt Romney wrote it.
George Romney.
Yes.
So, did any of you get to see the remake?
Nope. No, I never saw it.
I was thinking about, but everything came down to the wire for me, so I only had time for to have to squeeze the two films.
I gave you another week, you son of a.
I'm working.
I don't watch anything directed by.
I called you. I said, Eric, we're doing Justice League, and you were like, thank you, and you don't use that time.
It's true. I did do that.
I actually meant to watch it. I rented it, but I didn't have time. but I started it. It's directed by Antoine Fuqua, who...
That's why I didn't see it.
Yeah, a producer I worked with told me he is a no talent.
Already, it's a big negative because it is 5 minutes longer than the original.
It is. It's longer than the original. Just some things I picked up from it. The town is a... It's not a Mexican town. It's a kind of Anglo, typical Western town. And there's a mine, and there's like an evil guy who wants the mine. It opens with him. They're having this meeting on what to do. Are we going to stand up and fight, or what are we going to do? And the guy gives this... The evil guy shows up in the church, and he gives a speech about how religion and capitalism are very important to America. And then he burns the church down for them getting in the way of capitalism and God.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's...
The
cinematography is that very kind of overly warm cinematography you see in period Westerns now. It's actually the last film with a score by James Horner, who died before the movie came out, I think it's the last.
A blessing. For him.
Yes, for that he died before it came out. I watched the next scene, and it's a scene where Denzel goes into a bar. I'm a big Denzel Washington fan, by the way. And he is playing the Yul Brynner role. But it is very much kind of a post-Django kind of character, where he is, everybody's got their hand on their gun because the black dude's in a bar. It felt very much like they were kind of doing Magnificent Seven meets Django Unchained. I didn't hate it, but the opening scene went on much longer than it needed to. I didn't think the villain was all that impressive. He was no Eli Wallach. I wasn't a fan of the cinematography, but I like Chris Pratt. I like Denzel Washington. So I'm willing to give it a shot. I might try it out before I have to return it on Wednesday. So far, not as good as the Sturgis film.
I wonder why they would push... I mean, I don't know how woke it gets, but I wonder why they would push all of this woke crap on a movie that was never going to be seen by young people. In fact, the movie was like a minor hit because a bunch of boomers went to go see it.
I don't know. I think they might do it because Django Unchained is a pretty woke movie.
Well, I'm talking about Magnificent Seven. Yeah. Django makes sense. Tarantino brings in a youth crowd, brings in a black crowd. It makes sense. The remake of Magnificent Seven was never going to be this monster hit, and your audience was always going to be people over like 65.
But I feel like I know some people who saw it and enjoyed it, who are, you know, not woke. And the scene with Denzel that I was talking about, it's not like Django Unchained. But it does feel like, in that it's explicitly woke, but it does feel like a product of this. We wouldn't be seeing the scene if that film hadn't happened, if that makes sense.
Sure, yeah. I get you.
So far, not terrible, but also not anything to write home about, I guess.
When it was in the theaters, it was the first time in my adult life where there was three Westerns playing at the same time. And that may vary from theater to theater because the other two were limited releases.
But you also live in LA, dude.
No, this was in Miami.
Oh, this was in Miami. Oh.
Yeah, this was in Miami. Granted, I went to the one theater where I guess the limited stuff would play because I wanted to go see a particular one of the limited, and it ended up being something of a mistake. But so Magnificent Seven, the remake, was playing alongside Jane Got a Gun and In the Valley of Violence. I went to go see In the Valley of Violence.
I've never heard of either of those.
Jane Got a Gun is a Natalie Portman vanity project. In the Valley of Violence is a Ty West movie.
Whatever happened to Ty West? My goodness.
That movie happened. And I can't explain it on the show while we're recording, but I will tell you why his career isn't going the way that...
Because he was a guy to look out for a minute, you know, like House of the Devil and Innkeepers. Yeah. And...
It was all horror shit.
Sacrament.
I think House of the Devil is actually, like, in terms of a movie that... And I'd have to see it again. But in terms of a movie that, as far as authenticity for the period that it was trying to recreate, I think it does it very well.
Oh, I liked House of the Devil quite a bit.
I think Ronan Rowe, I think, told me that Ty West actually had like a pitch for a Halloween sequel that was pretty good, but the Akkads didn't go for it.
But the movie you said happened was In the Valley of Violence.
In the Valley of Violence with Ethan Hawke and John Travolta.
Ethan Hawke, who was in the Magnificent Seven remake.
That's right. Ethan Hawke has been a champion of the Western for the better part of a few years now. Magnificent Seven, the one we just talked about. He's in, I don't know if it's a Netflix show or some streaming show, The Good Lord Bird or whatever. Also, he was in that straight-to-video. Hey, he was in that straight-to-video The Kid.
Oh, yeah.
Well, nobody's going to hire him for a war movie or, like a tough guy, like modern action thing.
No, and he could be a cowboy because he's thin.
Is In the Valley of Violence worth watching?
No. It's an interesting movie, though. Okay. Not worth watching.
Yeah, it seems like Ty West has only done TV since that movie.
That movie is, I think, what got in the way of him getting a little bit bigger. I don't know if he's on the upswing again or not, but
well, he's been working.
Well, I mean, in feature films.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just saying, it just seems like he's still working.
Not that nowadays it really matters. I think you're probably doing better if you're on TV.
But he's probably one of the very, very few millennial filmmakers whose work I actually liked for a minute.
He makes a very millennial Western in the worst way possible.
Well, I liked his horror films just fine. Millennials, I don't think, are capable of making good Westerns.
Antithetical.
Millennials just are not good filmmakers in general. Like, any millennial filmmaker who's shown promise, like a Damien Chazelle or a Adam Wingard or something, they show a little bit of promise, but then it just goes down the toilet, you know?
I don't know if you heard it. I apologize for the fire alarm going off.
It's okay. You can set it off again if you want.
So, oh boy. Look, I took your advice on that one.
Sure.
All right.
Eric, well, we might have full-blown fire in the building. We don't have full-blown fire.
Eric.
All smoke. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, Eric, you go ahead and rate Magnificent Seven.
As my building is burning down, I will give Magnificent Seven.
Eric just died. The roof collapsed. He's dead.
I want to say 6.5, but I'm going to say a 7, not because I'm trying to be gimmicky, but because of the great scenes we talked about, and also it's a movie with all these cool cats in it, so you got to give it at least a 7. So that's my rating.
John, what about you?
Give it an 8.5.
I'll give it an 8. I give it an 8 because it's got a lot of cool dudes in it. It's got a lot of great Western actors. It's a really fun, if you want to watch Seven Samurai in an abridged form, it's a good way to do it. And it, just a good solid action Western. Eric, where can they find you and your bells?
Eric Zaldivar on YouTube. Zaldivar, Zaldivar. Nothing fancy.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, John, anything to plug before we go?
No, not this week.
All right. Well, in that case, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
That's about all. Peace out.
I'm going to say I'll be back unless I have a toastier death. That's a callback from earlier in the show.
That's right.
A toastier death.
Toasty!
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com, type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.